As a longtime foreign correspondent, I've worked in lots of places, but nowhere as important to the world as China. I'm Jane Perlez, former Beijing bureau chief for The New York Times. Join me on my new podcast, Face Off, U.S. versus China, where I'll take you behind the scenes in the tumultuous U.S.-China relationship. Find Face Off wherever you get your podcasts.
This is Silicon Valley, a region roughly between San Jose and San Francisco that is the global center for technology, innovation, and their corresponding industries. The general Silicon Valley metropolitan area has the third highest GDP per capita in the world, only just falling behind Zurich in Switzerland and Oslo in Norway, which are both significantly smaller economic regions overall. This otherwise unremarkable stretch of land, roughly 50 kilometers long and 25 kilometers wide, produces more economic output than most countries in the world. That's thanks to the institutions that operate there, which range from the most valuable company in the world to startups working out of converted garages, as well as investment funds, universities, and yes, the banks that facilitate and encourage the innovation that drives this region. Obviously, since we took our time to make this video, you already know which one of these groups is making headlines. 2 weeks ago, Silicon Valley Bank, one of the most important financial intermediaries in one of the most important industrial centers in the world, failed. Depositors were literally lining up outside the bank's doors in scenes that most economists assumed had been relegated to the history books. Within the same week, another two banks, Signature and Silvergate, also failed and have since put immense pressure on more banks like Credit Suisse and First Republic, which have required assistance to avoid failing themselves. One large bank failure, even in isolation, is a serious problem to the wider economy. But three bank failures, especially ones as large as SVB and Signature Bank, in such a short period of time, has always meant recession or depression. 1873, the Jay & Coke Company Bank, a pioneer of new technologies like telegraph messaging to confirm transactions, collapsed after they failed to sell enough railroad bonds quickly enough to cover withdrawals. The bank failure triggered other bank runs and kicked off the Panic of 1873, which was called the Great Depression until five decades later. 1893, new investments into novel assets like farmland in Argentina and properties in Australia fell dramatically in price, leaving the banks facilitating and encouraging these purchases exposed to bank runs and a deep depression that impacted every sector of the economy. The fallout was so severe in the USA that it led to widespread cultural changes across the country, now referred to as the political realignment. 1907, a loss of confidence amongst depositors during a difficult period of economic uncertainty exacerbated by new and unregulated investments caused numerous bank runs and a deep drop in financial markets. 1929, the Great Depression, the real one this time. The most intense economic downturn in the 20th century was caused by an economic contagion that started with a sharp drop in the stock market, leading to bank runs that rippled through the economy, forcing industry to grind to a halt. 1986, savings and loans associations, which were effectively just another type of bank focusing on consumer savings and consumer loans, experienced a run as their business model came under question during rising interest rates that were needed to combat inflation. The bank failures heightened already difficult economic times. 2008, banks that facilitated and encouraged a new type of investment were put under pressure when the value of those investments fell. The market panic eventually resulted in the single biggest bank failure in US history, Washington Mutual, and kicked off the economic recession that we are still feeling the effects of to this day.
Want to learn how you can make smarter decisions with your money? Well, I've got the podcast for you. I'm Sean Piles, and I host NerdWallet's Smart Money Podcast. On our show, we help listeners like you make the most of your finances. I sit down with NerdWallet's team of nerds, personal finance experts in credit cards, banking, investing, and more. We answer your real-world money questions and break down the latest personal finance news. The nerds will give you the clarity you need by cutting through the clutter and misinformation in today's world of personal finance. We don't promote get-rich-quick schemes or hype unrealistic side hustles. Instead, we offer practical knowledge that you can apply in your everyday life. You'll learn about strategies to help you build your wealth, invest wisely, shop for financial products, and plan for major life events. And you'll walk away with the confidence you need to ensure that your money is always working as hard as you are. So turn to the nerds to answer your real-world money questions and get insights that can help you make the smartest financial decisions for your life. Listen to NerdWallet's Smart Money Podcast wherever you get your podcasts.
Hey there, I'm Dylan Lewis, one of the hosts of Motley Fool Money. Each weekday on Motley Fool Money, we talk through the business news you need to know and the stories moving stocks on Wall Street. On weekends, we dive into the industries shaping tomorrow and host the experts, authors, and executives that understand them. Tune in for insights, a long-term perspective on investing, and of course, stock ideas, plenty of them. To quote a listener, it pays to listen. Check us out and subscribe wherever you listen to podcasts.
2023. After 3 years of unprecedented economic turbulence, kicked off by the global pandemic and heightened by trade tensions, a war in Europe, developing market debt crises, and a hangover from the stimulus measures meant to fight these shocks, the economy was in an uncertain position. Banks using new technology to encourage and facilitate investments into new and unique assets have started to fail as the depositors became uncertain about their solvency in the current high interest rate and high inflation market. So far, the total value of bank failures is roughly equal to the first year of the GFC, with many economists and commentators predicting that this is just the start of things and that a lot of other banks from around the world are going to be put under similar pressures in the coming months. So, to make sense of what this means for the wider economy this time around, we need to, as always, answer a few important questions. What is causing these most recent bank failures? Why wasn't the government or the Fed able to stop it? Are more bank failures likely to follow? And finally, will these bank failures cause wider economic problems like they have in the past? The 2023 bank failures have so far all had a few things in common. For starters, all of the banks were involved in providing financial services for niche markets rather than everyday consumers. Silvergate and Signature did a lot of their business with cryptocurrency exchanges and investors, and Silicon Valley Bank focused on providing services to the types of businesses that make Silicon Valley the global centre of innovation. The banks also had very large account sizes. The average bank account size in the average bank in the USA was $41,600 as of 2019. It's probably slightly higher than that now thanks to pandemic-era savings, but this figure is an average, so it's skewed up a lot by the enormous accounts held by companies and very rich individuals. The median account balance, as in the account that was exactly in the middle of a group of accounts lined up from biggest to smallest, was $5,300. The average account balance for Silicon Valley Bank was over $1 million, and a lot of their services were not even available to people or companies that had less than that amount. Some of the bank's biggest depositors had tens of millions or even hundreds of millions of dollars in their account. Signature Bank, Silvergate Bank, and other banks that have been shaken by this market panic like Credit Suisse also have very large average account sizes because they attract large companies and wealthy people. The problem this created for the banks is that their depositors' money was mostly not covered by the FDIC, which guarantees the first $250,000 kept with the bank. For the median person with an account balance of just $5,300, this guarantee is good enough that they don't have to worry about their bank failing because all of their money will be covered, and the worst thing that might happen to them is a minor inconvenience while they are reimbursed for their lost funds. This guarantee made Great Depression-style bank runs a thing of the past because nowadays there really is no need for regular people to withdraw their money to keep it safe. In fact, the FDIC was first introduced in 1934 as a response to the economic problems caused by bank failures during the Great Depression. But when most accounts held at a bank would not be covered by this limit, it reintroduces the risk of bank runs. The solution to this problem would just be to remove the limit. That way, any amount of money would be covered, which means even very wealthy account holders would have no real need to rush their money out of a bank, which could counterintuitively make it less likely that the FDIC or other institutions in other countries would ever need to pay out. While making this video, we were lucky enough to speak to Jean-Edouard Colliard, a financial regulation professor from HEC Paris and a former economics policy advisor for the European Central Bank, who spoke about the problems with introducing limitless coverage to bank accounts.
So the thing is that in principle, there is a trade-off when you insure deposits. And so this is a trade-off that has always existed. So on the one hand, you could say, well, you know, if deposits are uninsured, there's going to be a lot of bank runs because depositors are going to react very, very strongly each time they see a signal that a bank might not be doing too well. Okay, so that generated a lot of banking panics, for instance, in the early 1930s in the US, and that's why the FDIC was introduced. At the same time, if you insure, you know, all the depositors, even, you know, large and sophisticated ones, this is also an issue because now the bank has a lot of liabilities. And these liabilities are all insured. So you have created a very strange company that has a lot of leverage, a lot of creditors. And these creditors, they are insured by someone else, so they no longer care about the risk that the bank is taking.
The FDIC, in a joint statement with the Treasury and the Federal Reserve, made the decision in this case to offer unlimited coverage given the circumstances. And their wording made it clear that they would continue to do this for any other bank failures that may occur in the immediate future. People were annoyed that this was yet another bank bailout that would ultimately be paid for by the taxpayers, which is not entirely true, but also not entirely wrong either. The Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation is exactly that, an insurance corporation. It doesn't get its money from taxpayers, it charges banks and other deposit-taking institutions for insurance. Because it has had to make such a big payout, the FDIC will increase how much money it charges all the other banks for its protection, and those additional charges will indirectly be passed along to bank customers as higher fees, lower interest rates on savings, or higher interest rates on loans. The other concern amongst a lot of people is that since the banks got covered by the FDIC this time around, they'll continue to make more money and take more risks in the future, knowing that they will always be too big to fail. The concerns are understandable, but in this case, they are honestly just wrong. The shareholders in all of these banks who ultimately made the decisions about how the banks are run got wiped out. Only the people keeping their money with these banks that otherwise had no involvement in their operations got their money back, so this is not sending the message that this is a good way to run a profitable bank. There is definitely an argument for the problems of moral hazard in the banking sector, but this is not the example that the let them fail advocates should really be using. Now, while the FDIC has stepped up to try and make sure that nobody rushes to take their money out of any more banks by ensuring that everyone will be covered, in theory, it should have never got to this point, because it's the Fed's job to make sure that this never happens. Silicon Valley Bank had enough assets to cover its deposits. It was actually holding most of its assets as government treasuries, which are theoretically the safest investment that anyone can hold. The problem was, as you're probably aware by now, that their value has an inverse relationship with interest rates in the short term, so they purchased these bonds while interest rates were low and then tried to sell them when interest rates were high to free up enough cash to cover an unprecedented amount of withdrawals. This was a failure of the bank. They should have known that covering interest-bearing accounts with interest-bearing assets was a huge risk, even if the assets themselves were very safe.
Now, if the bank invests a lot in treasuries, when interest rates increase, simultaneously, the value of these treasuries is going to decrease, okay, which is normal. And at the same time, the depositors on the liability side are going to ask for higher and higher interest rates. At some point, actually, a bank with only treasuries might fail because the interest it has to serve to the depositors are actually higher than the revenues it gets from the treasuries.
Either way, the bank still had assets, it was just forced to sell them at the wrong time. The Federal Reserve Bank is supposed to act as a lender of last resort in these situations. That's literally the reason the institution was first created. The idea is that if any bank gets in trouble and they don't have enough cash on hand to cover withdrawals, they can go to the central bank to get a short-term loan so that they can pay the people trying to take the money out. The central bank does this because it knows if just one person can't get their deposits out of the bank on demand, it could start a panic that could cause bank runs on multiple banks and stress the entire financial system. So, why didn't they do that here? The answer so far is not entirely clear. It would either be because the run just happened so quickly that the Fed and SVB didn't have time to arrange emergency liquidity, or the Fed decided the bank was doomed no matter what and giving them emergency loans would just be a waste of money.
The catch is that lending of last resort is supposed to mean that you lend to banks that are solvent and they are just illiquid. Okay. The problem in reality is that it's very rare that we have banks that are in perfectly good shape, their solvency is not at all in question, and just people become completely crazy and run on the bank.
Credit Suisse is put under similar withdrawal pressure this week as fears over bank failures circulated around the world. That bank was allowed to borrow $54 billion from the Swiss Central Bank to ensure its liquidity. So either Switzerland reacted faster, the much larger Credit Suisse was seen as a safer bet, or it was just so essential to the financed-focused Swiss economy that it got everything it needed no matter what, where SVB was slightly more expendable to the much larger and more diversified economy of the USA. Now, despite the stability hit the banking system has taken and the loss of confidence a lot of people have in it, a lot of economists aren't too concerned about these recent bank failures, even though in the past they've meant almost certain doom for the broader economy. So, does that mean that banks no longer matter? Banks have a very important role to play in the economy, but they are less important today than they have been in the past. One of their most important functions is simply serving as a place for people to keep their money so that it can't be stolen or lost in something like a house fire. Money kept in a bank account, when combined with modern technology like credit cards and electronic payments, is also easier to spend. This helps increase something that economists call the velocity of money, which is how quickly money changes hands. If people spend money quicker, then it can flow through more businesses and create more employment, which, all other things being equal, is an ideal outcome. Banks also have another important role, which is to lend that money out to individuals and businesses. This puts more money into the economy, and in the case of businesses, can help build companies that don't have enough capital to get started, but once they do, can add value to the economy and provide employment. If that wasn't already important enough to the functioning of the economy, banks can combine their role as a deposit taker and loan maker to pull a really cool trick called the money multiplier. if someone deposits $10,000 into their bank and that bank only has a reserve requirement of 10%, then that means that they can lend out $9,000 to someone else who will spend that money at a business that will then deposit that money into their bank account. And then their bank can loan out $8,100 until eventually $100,000 has been created in the banking system from just that initial $10,000. That is a pretty impressive trick that was beautifully illustrated by one of my favourite creators on YouTube in a video they did about these recent bank collapses. But it's also wrong. The banking system doesn't work like this. Bank deposits, at least in the USA and most other advanced economies, do not get loaned out. They stay in what is known as the interbank system and are only traded around between other banks. Banks don't need your deposits. They can just create money in an account, and the only limit on them doing that is not how much money they have from depositors, it's how much demand they have from borrowers that meet their lending criteria and the lending criteria of government bodies. Silicon Valley Bank is a great example. Most of its assets were low-yielding government treasury bonds because it didn't have enough customers that it could responsibly lend to. It would have preferred to create loans with higher interest rates than less than 1% that they were making on their treasuries, but in the real economy, there is just not an endless line of good borrowers waiting to get a loan. The money multiplier myth is so pervasive that the Fed itself had to release a paper so that economics teachers at schools and universities would stop teaching it. A bank's true role is something called maturity transformation. Depositors will leave money in their bank accounts, but they'll never be totally sure when they'll need to use it, so the time horizon of that allocation of capital is unknown. Banks can take short-term capital like this and use it as the basis for loans in projects that will take a long time to pay off. Last year's Nobel Prize winners got the award for the work they did in clarifying this role of financial intermediaries, but they are not the only institutions making these kinds of capital allocations anymore. Growing inequality has meant that money has been held in the hands of very wealthy people that have a lot more capital than they'll ever need day to day. What this means is that they don't need to keep most of their money in a bank account. They can keep a bit to cover expenses, but most of it will be directly invested instead of indirectly invested through a bank. Businesses trying to get started used to go out and get a loan from the bank, but now responsible lending to new businesses is very hard because regulations want to ensure that the loan will be repaid, and most new businesses don't succeed. So today, a lot of business funding is done by investment firms that raise cash from a growing number of extremely rich people that want to invest.
I think the business model of banks in general, and you know, the case for having a lot of financial intermediation being done by banks, I think this case is getting weaker over time. And the fundamental business model of banks is a bit less clear today than it used to be. So, you know, it used to be the case that maturity transformation was something very important for the economy, that a lot of the savings were in the form of small retail deposits, and you wanted to use these savings to finance companies, so you needed to have banks, basically, right? Nowadays, we have much more economic inequality, so, you know, maybe we can have richer people just investing into funds, and those funds are going to finance the companies, and so there is much less scope for, you know, collecting small deposits in order to finance new companies. So that's a possibility. Maybe maturity transformation is less important today than it was. Also, banks, you know, do a lot of activities combined. Historically, this was a good idea because you needed to have a one-stop shop, you know, to have a single bank advisor to do a lot of things. Nowadays, with the internet, you can break, you know, the banking services into many different subcomponents. And so you don't need maybe to have the same bank doing everything for you. You could have, you know, someone doing your investments, someone you borrow from, someone you take your deposits, and so on and so on. All this could be done sometimes by fintech, sometimes by a bank, and so on. And so there could be many different intermediaries. So I think there are many reasons why maybe society could rely less on banks today than it used to.
For the economic system as a whole, this might not be a great trend, but it does mean that what we are seeing today is likely bank failures as a result of poor economic conditions, not poor economic conditions as the result of bank failures. Our entire interview with Jean-Edouard, where we discussed everything from state-run banks to how much regulation is too much regulation and what we would have done differently if we were put in charge of these banks, is available on the Economics Explained Spotify page. Thanks for watching, mate. Bye.
Want to learn how you can make smarter decisions with your money? Well, I've got the podcast for you. I'm Sean Piles, and I host NerdWallet's Smart Money Podcast. Our show features our team of nerds, personal finance experts in credit cards, banking, investing, and more. And they'll help you make the most of your money while cutting through the clutter and misinformation in today's world of personal finance. You'll get clarity on strategies to help you build your wealth, invest wisely, shop for financial products, and plan for major life events. Listen to NerdWallet's Smart Money Podcast wherever you get your podcasts.